the northern extension of the kingdom, Euphrates. And also, the fourth map we looked at before, there's a couple of cities that are going to be mentioned. Jerusalem to the south, which is just off the Dead Sea. Obviously, that's headquarters. But also, Gibeon is going to be mentioned, and we're going to see why. But again, Jerusalem, Gibeon is just 5 miles north, northwest of Jerusalem. Okay? So, chapter 3, that's where we're beginning tonight. So as I fast forward, let's open our, because I got to go to chapter 3. Oh, there it is. Solomon forms a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, and he brought Pharaoh's daughter to Jerusalem. And at this point, he didn't have the temple, the wall around Jerusalem, or Solomon's own personal house built at this point. But he still forms this marriage alliance, and it appears to be political, with Pharaoh. And continuing with verse 3 through 15, this is where Solomon goes to Gibeon. That's a city just 5 miles north of Jerusalem. And what was the reason for that? Well, at this point, is the temple built?
No.
Just told you it was not. It's not built. Therefore, they're still relying on Gibeon as being the great high place. That's where the sacrifices were supposed to be done, at Gibeon, according to Leviticus 17, verses 8 and 9, and also Deuteronomy 12, verses 5, 6, 11, and 13. The Israelites were still supposed to use the tabernacle, and therefore the altar at the tabernacle, for their sacrifices. At this point, it's at Gibeon. That's where the tabernacle is, according to those verses. Therefore, that's the actual best location for sacrifices to be made. So as we see verses such as 3, where it mentions that Solomon pleased God, except, and it's used that term, except, he offered on high places that would mention other than the one at Gibeon, such as the one at Jerusalem. There's a high place in Jerusalem, but therefore the verses mention that it should have been, the law was saying, the sacrifices until the temple was built, that the sacrifice should have been made at the tabernacle, which is the tabernacle's at Gibeon. Yes, sir? Well, another thing, at this point, one commentator said that Egypt may have been declining, so therefore they were forming this alliance so that Solomon wouldn't destroy them or overtake them. So therefore, that was the reason they thought. Of course, it was good for both, Solomon and for... But of course, it makes you wonder, Solomon knew he wasn't supposed to marry, and that's why I originally had that Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter. I changed it because it's just indicating they had an alliance. It doesn't necessarily indicate... doesn't mention her name. Normally when there's a marriage, that mentions the wife's name and doesn't mention any children necessarily. We can research that further. I don't know that for certain. If there's any children ever mentioned through Pharaoh's daughter, if there is, please let me know.
Do you have any idea what Pharaoh might have been?
The commentary I read didn't indicate. I can go back and check, though, as far as... But see, it doesn't mention the Pharaoh's name at this point. Of course, it could, based on timing, yes, we can pretty much tell which, based on the history, the Pharaoh's name made the alliance. But there's no, again, mention of the daughter's name.
Well, that marriage would have been illegal under the law.
Well, that's what, yes, exactly. Right, which, that's why we can't say for certain, but it appears to be political. But yet, yes, Exodus 34:16, they were not supposed to marry foreigners, which is very clear. Solomon knows that. I mean, there's no doubt that he knew that.
And but you know, there's a little-known law in the Old Testament that kings were not to increase their wives. They were supposed to make out their own copy of the law and they didn't do that so far as we know. And as far as him and Cruz and his wives, I don't know, I always get it confused how many he had, but it was way too many. And if you look at the terms of the law, he had to give every one of those wives 1 year of his life. He could do nothing but take care of her. Well, he didn't have enough days in his
life to do that. No, he had 300 wives and 700 concubines.
He didn't have enough days in his life to do any of that. He was just absolutely acting stupid to be so wise.
That's one way to put it. That's one way to put it. He definitely amassed a lot. I mean, he definitely as he said, and he didn't hold back anything pretty much in his the way he had his luxuries or his vanity. That he went out and found all of these things and he had all these pleasures that he didn't hold back from any of those. What term I'm trying to look for. But it was all vanity and he just didn't hold back. And that's one of the things we can see. He didn't hold back as far as how many wives he had. Anyway. Yes, we could speak quite a while on that one. But anyway. Continuing on. In verses 3 through 15, this is where God appears to Solomon at Gibeon, where he had gone to make these sacrifices. God grants him a wish. And this is where Solomon, in his dream, asked God for wisdom. God is so pleased with this, he offers also honor and riches, down in verse 13. God is pleased with this. Then we know Solomon wakes up and sacrifices more. Okay? Verses 3 through 15. Then immediately after this, let's see, verse 15, wakes from the... Okay, in verse 15, he actually goes to the Ark of the Covenant, which would have been Jerusalem, and offers burnt offerings and peace offerings. So he had been to Gibeon to sacrifice to God. After he woke from his dream, he goes to Jerusalem to sacrifice also. So continually seeking to serve God, and that's what the verses indicate, he was seeking to be pleasing to God with all his heart. Then as we get to verses 16 through 28, immediately, this is that story we've all remember and heard, that he's tested. First thing, these two harlots or prostitutes come to him. Both have baby boys. One has died. They're both claiming the live one. Solomon calls for a sword, says to divide the child. Of course, we see the wisdom where the mother of the living child says, no, don't hurt him. Give him to the woman that wants him. The other woman says, no, go ahead and cut him. She's already had a loss. What more does she have to lose? So he sees he can see the difference, Solomon can. Then he knows which one is really the mother and gives it to her. So we see Solomon's wisdom immediately. And also in verse 28, the Israelites begin to see Solomon's wisdom very quickly, and they also realize it's from God. Any questions or comments before we go to chapter 4? We do need to move along as best we can, but it doesn't matter. We can't have questions back here. Pete, yes, sir?
Just a quick one.
Yes, sir?
Since Solomon wasn't a priest, was he allowed to go into the high places and before the Ark of the Covenant? I thought that was kind of limited to...
Just for the high priest, are they supposed to be the ones to go into the most holy place? Yes. Does it mention him going to the most holy place, though? I don't remember. Well... Now remember, I think it appeared he went to the altar to burn. Now is the altar in the most holy place, Tom?
No.
I didn't think so. I thought the altar was outside where they could, anybody, well, not anybody.
Stood before the ark.
Right.
Okay, that would be in the most holy place. Excuse me.
His daddy used to go in all the time and talk to God.
Good question. He's not, doesn't appear he was stopped. That's true. But
well, sometimes... language he's used in such a way that a person doesn't do it themselves, but if he had the sacrifices done, it could still be said that he did it.
Attributed to him.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like Pilate scourged Jesus. Well, he didn't personally do it. He ordered his men to do it. So that could be what's indicated, you know, in those passages. As far as being before the ark, that wouldn't necessarily mean literally 2 feet from it. Just he went to...
offer the sacrifice.
Was in Jerusalem, and that's where he made the sacrifice. Because obviously the altar is outside in front of the tabernacle, not actually in, inside the tabernacle itself.
Well, that makes sense. In actuality, you really couldn't see a king actually doing the sacrifices if you think about it. It does say he did them, but if you think about it, he probably would have to make more sense that he was there, but would have the priest do it. But nonetheless, does that answer your question, Pete?
Yes, thank you. Well, and of course, the sacrifice required the offer to cut the throat of the animal and so on. I mean, every sacrificer, every individual who brought a sacrifice had a part to play in it. Mm-hmm. Just the priests were the ones that had to put the carcass on the
flame.
Flame and deal with the blood and all that stuff.
Shane.
Do we know approximately how old Solomon was at this point in time?
Some commentators thought as young as 12, which is very young, but most think about 20 or older at this point as he's made the alliance with Pharaoh's.
Yeah, I know growing up, it was always attributed to him as being a young boy when this took place, mm-hmm. but I don't see anything really that would indicate it, especially if he's, the English Standard Version says that he made a marriage alliance with the Pharaoh mm-hmm. and taking Pharaoh's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly wouldn't be.
But more than likely. At that age, right. More than likely in his 20s is what the commentator said. Yes, sir.
Well, when the Lord asked him what he wanted, he said, I'm just a little child mm-hmm. trying to lead this people. If you took that literally, that mm-hmm. might indicate he was a little kid. But I would suspect he was speaking, in the exact
figuratively about himself, about his dealings with the Israelites. Well, that's why I think it's stressing alliance. That's what, that it's just done to make both kind of, an alliance, make them happy, I guess, so they just get along.
Of course, a lot of marriages, even today, are arranged, but it may be that the actual ceremony is in the future. In certain parts of the world.
Okay, chapter 4. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
This footnote says that he made himself a son-in-law of Pharaoh, which would imply, legal marriage. Mm-hmm.
Do you ever see where it mentions her name, though? That's what throws me, why it doesn't mention Pharaoh's daughter. Anyway, son-in-law of Pharaoh would imply marriage. Yes, sir. Anything else about the marriage, though? Okay. Yes, sir.
It's interesting. We often think of Solomon, the wisdom that God gives him, but specifically phrase that he'd be given wisdom to discern between good and evil, so that he can govern the people. And then we have this little narrative that essentially shows us just how well God answered prayer. And like as you pointed out in verse 28, people realize that the wisdom of God was given to him. Looks at these two women and says, one of you is telling the truth and one of you is lying. Not just that he had knowledge, but he was able to discern people's hearts in a sense and act as God's judge. Which is very significant for the world.
I meant to make that comment, yes, earlier. Thank you, because he did ask that he could judge for his people because he felt so inadequate at that point. And we see what eventually the wives do to him, see, but Jesus remained obviously sinless. We can see the difference, definitely. Yes, sir?
I wanted to ask a question, too, in chapter 3, down in verse 3, it talks about how Solomon had loved the Lord and walked in the statutes of God as did David, except he burned incense in the highest places. Exactly what did that involve?
Well, that's what I mentioned earlier. When Lee Wildman was here, he touched on it. What it was, see, the temple hasn't been built. This is just a roundabout way. The temple hadn't been built, so they chose places to sacrifice or built high places. But they were supposed to actually at the tabernacle, which was Gibeon. But therefore, they built these high places at various locations, even in Jerusalem, various locations to sacrifice. But according to the passage again in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, it appears that they were only supposed to sacrifice at the tabernacle until, and again, it said several times also, that he didn't have the house built, the temple, which would be the central location, wasn't built at this point. Therefore, they were sacrificing at other places besides Gibeon until the temple was built.
And it seems like this was just an ongoing problem throughout the period of Kings after they had...
Exactly. That, we're going to get to that where...
They couldn't get away from it.
Once the northern kingdom cut off Jerusalem, they're like, we got to do something about taking care of our worship, in which they turned to idolatry quickly. The northern, well, the southern also, but the northern kingdom really went to idolatry and remained in idolatry throughout their existence. Good point. Chapter 4, Solomon places officials, and as I mentioned before, verse 4, one of those was Benaiah. He was his Solomon's go-to man, and now he's the captain or the commander of the army. As we go to verses 7 through 19, Solomon places 12 deputies, and they're going to have a special duty. But in verse 11 and 15, just FYI, two of those deputies are son-in-laws to Solomon. Now, these deputies, there's 12 of them for a reason. They have special duties for each month they're supposed to supply Solomon's daily provisions, you might say. In verse 22 and 23, one per month are to provide for Solomon, his guests, his household, and of course some of his horses and so forth, livestock for feeding and so forth, taken care of per month. And they take turns, as you see, there's 12 of them. And then in verse 22 and 23, which is in the next section actually, it tells what Solomon's daily provisions were, and it's quite outstanding. And of course you could think of taking care of all of his household, his guests, the officials that it mentions and so forth, and all of his, you might say, entourage, cabinet and so forth, all of his people near and around him at all times. It's quite an elaborate outlay of food and daily provisions in verse 22 and 23. And as we go on to 20 through 34, we see that Solomon reigned over Israel and Judah in peace. Peace prevails. Verse 20 and 21 mentions what I had mentioned earlier, the dimensions of his kingdom, and verse 25 mentioned the river, I believe, to Philistia, and also from Dan to Beersheba, as we mentioned before, just roughly the northern to southern tips of the kingdom at that point, but reaching as far as, again, what's referred to as the river would refer to the great river Euphrates to the north. So you might think it was Jordan, but actually it refers to the river Euphrates to the north as a, quote, northern boundary all the way down to Beersheba. It's just a rough estimate of the dimensions of his kingdom at this point. Verse 32, Solomon had spoken 3,000 proverbs, had written 1,005 songs just in his lifetime. Just a quick overview. Chapter 5, Solomon begins collecting materials to build the temple. Yes, sir?
I'd just like to point out something in chapter 4 that's not immediately obvious, but it will be crucial. We've had hints already of the division between Israel and Judah. Absalom led Israel away from David's support in Judah. Sheba's rebellion was separating Israel from Judah. And, of course, David was able to kind of keep that patch together. Now what Solomon has done here, he's realigned the definition of the nation. It's no longer the 12 tribes. He has these taxation districts overseen by these individuals. And they represent the entire nation except for Judah. So the taxation is disproportionately borne by Israel. And Judah is heavily favored in this. And this is going to contribute to this animosity between Israel and Judah.
When they approach him to reduce the tax.
Play into that taxation problem later on with Rehoboam.
I was going to say, when they ask Rehoboam to reduce it, that's the...
Yeah.
Thank you.
So it's not like everybody's bearing the same load equally here. So.
that would definitely.
Another question about wisdom, perhaps, but I mean, obviously, the wisdom Solomon had didn't make him do the right thing, and you know, compel him always to follow the right decision. And it looks like at the end of chapter 4, his wisdom involved even knowledge of flora and fauna. You know, like he was a biologist and a naturalist and expert in all the affairs of creation around him. You know, kind of interesting.
All right, chapter 5, collecting the items. Hiram, king of Tyre, contacts Solomon by sending servants to him. And it just so happened that Solomon replies to Hiram at the beginning of chapter 5 that he plans to build the temple. He explains that David wanted to, but David was not allowed to, but God is allowing Solomon to do so. And by the way, verse 6, they're going to be needing timber. So the Sidonians were expert timbermen, and so Hiram in verse 7 was very happy to hear this, that they would be needing timber, and Hiram was going to be able to do that, take care of that for Solomon. So therefore, they're kind of realigning, and it mentions that Hiram had been a great friend of David, so he was wanting to continue this with Solomon. So this was good news to him. Plus, Solomon is offered to pay him also. So it's a double bonus. Alliance, peace, and a payment. So, as it says in verse 10, Hiram was going to supply cedars and cypress. And verse 11, Solomon paid Hiram yearly. And verse 12, there's peace between them. Verse 13 through 18, assigning the builders of the temple. And it's quite extensive. It just covers it in just a few verses. But if you think of the magnitude, he levied forced laborers from Israel, 30,000 men. And he's going to use 10,000 a month. They work a month and they're off 2 months. But they go to Lebanon to help Hiram and his men per month, 10,000 men. Then in verse 15, he also provides, Solomon provides 70,000 transporters, 80,000 masons. If you think of the magnitude of it, it's just a lot. It's just a lot. And also, 2 Chronicles 2, 17 and 18 mentions that some of these forced laborers also included aliens or foreigners that were living in Israel. So they're not all Israelites. Solomon forced those who were foreigners to actually work for him. That's why it's referred to as forced labor in some cases. But again, that's just a lot of people. A lot of people, if you think about that. All right, continuing. Any questions? Chapter 6. Yes, sir.
All the forced laborers were aliens, weren't they?
Well, it indicated that he levied forced laborers from Israel, 30,000 of them, but yet, okay, it does indicate. Okay, 2:17. Okay, but didn't mention any? Okay. I need to study that more, because I was thinking he did use Israel, some Israelites, but it's indicating he didn't in chapter 9, 22. Okay, because I've looked at that, but I didn't catch. All right. Thank you. Foreigners. Well, that's what 2 Chronicles 2 had definitely mentioned, that the forced laborers, I thought they included, but it may have been just. Okay, thank you. All right, let me read verse 13 again. What I may have done is, five, verse 13. Now, King Solomon levied forced laborers from all Israel, and the forced laborers numbered, okay. what I may have thought from Israel being Israelites, but then if you put the other verse together, it would mean that they did come from foreigners, not Israelites.
Well, there were other nations that were still living there. Mm-hmm. People had destroyed when they went into the land. They were tricked by some, you know, into making, you know, compact weapons.
Treaty, right.
And not destroyed. They may have picked they were far away and they were actually people of the land.
Right there.
Those
they tricked them. In the land. Pete?
The ESV has a reference at the bottom that basically said that he didn't draft anybody that are conscript Israelites, but only workers from the Canaanite population of Israel.
Okay. So therefore, only foreigners, no Israelites. Nonetheless, it's a lot. That's a lot of people. Good point. Just foreigners, no Israelites. After that's amassed, chapter 6, the construction begins. In the fourth year of Solomon's reign, began to build the temple. The timber, the stones, the supplies, etc. Verse 2, the dimensions, length, 60 cubits, and if a cubit is 18 inches, that would be roughly 90 feet long. The width, 20 cubits, or approximately 30 feet. Height, 30 cubits, or approximately 45. Again, 90 feet long, this is approximately 90 feet long, 30 feet wide, 45 feet in height. The stone was prepared at the quarry and set in place on site in Jerusalem. In verse 7, no hammer, axe, or any iron tool was heard at the construction site. Therefore, everything was done at the quarry and just simply brought and assembled at the temple site. So if you can imagine, it was probably pretty quiet if you think of it. No actual, a lot of noise, just men moving and setting and assembling. It's something to think about. But that it makes sense if you see sending 80,000 masons to the quarry, 70,000 transporters, 10,000 laborers at a time to help. Just anyway. I could imagine they were just that accurate. But you're right. They may have had backups. They may have had other pieces to come just in case it didn't fit because they didn't do any shaving there. It would have, you're right, gone back or they would have had to have duplicates because no hammers or iron implements were used at the temple site. As we see it from hindsight, I keep thinking of that too. God knows that the temple's not going to last. You know, just think of that. These guys are looking at it like this is going to last forever. Just think of it. They're pouring all this into it. Of course, why would they not? Why would they be haphazard? You know, and you think, God knows. And in God's wisdom, unfortunately, we're not looking at it that way. Just think how difficult it would be for us to grasp and deal with that. But God's wisdom allows him to know why they're doing this, allowing them to do it, but it's not going to last. It's temporary. Good point. Verse 11 through 13. I didn't put my verses up. I guess I just did the whole chapter. Verse 11 through 13. The Lord reminds Solomon to obey, and the Lord will be with him. If he forsakes the Lord, or he'll forsake him if Solomon disobeys. And it goes into a lot of detail. Verse 15. The inside walls were covered with cedar. Floor covered with cypress. Verse 16, the most holy place on the back of the temple measured 20 cubits, or which would be 30 feet. Verse 21 and 22, overlaid inside and whole house with gold. Verse 23, the inner sanctuary with two cherubims made of olive wood, both 10 cubits, which is roughly 15 feet high. If you think of it, that's That's, I never envisioned it being 15 feet high, if, again, a cubit is a foot and a half. The wings were open across the room and touching, meeting in the middle. That's verse 27. And verse 38 indicates it took 7 years in the building of the temple. 7 years in the construction. Not the amassing, that was simply the construction. Yes, sir?
I think you'll find that the Holy of Holies was a perfect cube of 30 feet.
30 by 30 by... kind of an indication of perfection, you might think. Yes, sir.
Do you think the iron's not made with a hammer or chisel is some kind of connection possibly to the, when they built the altar, when they came into the promised land, they weren't able to, the stones were not to be chiseled at all because it profaned the altar. Maybe they tried to make a connection to that.
That's what I was thinking.
Following that format. Good point. Good point. Well, we know he definitely quarried it because it mentioned the quarry, and these were expert men with the stone. Yes, sir. Cube also. Good point. Good point. And
these dimensions are twice that of the tabernacle, otherwise the same proportion.
I've seen a footnote about that, but I didn't see anything that backed that up. But it's definitely just exactly duplicate or twice as the tabernacle.
10 cubits becomes 20 cubits.
All right, as we get to chapter 7, we almost did. I was supposed to get through chapter 8. But just thinking of all this that Solomon has done, David wanted to, but wasn't able to. And at the end of Samuel, in 2 Samuel, I've forgotten, no, it's chapter 24. Yes, I did write it down. In 2 Samuel 24, we mentioned at the beginning of this class that that's the way Samuel ended with David, that this plague had happened. David wanted to sacrifice to God, So he went and found this threshing floor and wanted to sacrifice, but the man wanted to give it to him. I forgot the man's name, but he wanted to give David the threshing floor, but David wouldn't take it. He said, I must pay for it. And so therefore, what he's indicating is if there's no cost, there's no sacrifice. And that's what David was saying, that he's not going to take this threshing floor and offer a sacrifice to God. He's going to pay for it. And the other things he purchased to sacrifice to God, so therefore it was going to cost him and be a sacrifice for him to sacrifice to God. And we see that further in what Solomon's doing. The cost of this, what Solomon's putting into it, all this detail, he's making sure that it costs. It's not cutting any corners per se. If we could only see the magnitude of it, I would imagine it would be the eighth wonder of the world, I mean, if it was still standing today. And of course, obviously, we already said it's not. But yet, it would be probably magnificent and amazing for us to look at the detail they put into it, the gold and so forth, the cedar and cypress, where those things would even last to this point. But yet, some of it, I'm sure, would have lasted had men not destroyed it. Yes, sir?
I remember when the tabernacle was built, that the Old Testament says that God gave special gifts to the craftsmen. But there's no mention of that here, so I don't know if that was not the case with the craftsmen. But I do remember that being said.
You're absolutely right. Back then, it did indicate that they were given special... true. Good point. Good point. But I didn't see any verse that indicated that there was any special gift or guidance, you might say, in that area. Absolutely. Any questions through chapter 6? All right, we can go ahead and start in chapter 7. After he finishes the temple 7 years, he turns to his own house, and it immediately says it took 13 years for him to build his house, and it gives it... dimensions. His foundations were of large stones, 10 cubits. In other words, some of the stones were 15 feet long, if a cubit is 18 inches. Some of the stones were 8 cubits, which would be 12 feet, and that's in verse 10 of chapter 7. Quite elaborate, his own plan for his palace. then it turns back to the furnishings of the temple. Kind of took a segue there. Here he's got his own construction of his house going on after he constructed the temple. But the furnishings for the temple starts in verses 13 through 51. And again, they're quite detailed and quite intricate. Solomon brings in another Hiram, a different one. He's of the tribe of Naphtali. This one is a worker in bronze, and it goes into detail, verse 15, of what he makes out of bronze, the detail, the intricacy, and what it was for. Verse 21, pillars were built, two of them, given names. One was Jachin, which means he shall establish. Another pillar was named Boaz, and in it is strength, is what it means. Very intricate, very detailed. Verse 23, a sea of cast metal made into a circle, 10 cubits across or 15 feet across, and it stood on 12 oxen, three of them facing each of the four directions, three facing north, south, east, and west to make the 12 oxen. They're all facing outward. And verse 26 gives the dimensions of this metal bath, or what you would call a bath, would hold approximately, and this is just a guesstimate, 12,000 gallons. Verse 45 mentions again, well, that Hiram was a worker in bronze. All the utensils were made of polished bronze, and they were cast between Succoth and Zarethan. It's where these items were made, and then they were transported to the temple. Verse 47, there were so many items that the bronze was not weighed. It didn't give this is how many pounds of bronze or how many items. It was a matter of there were so many it was left unweighed. In other words, not estimated or counted. And if you want to look at verse 48 through 51, many, many items going into the temple made of gold, silver, bronze. And Solomon begins putting these in the temple. Let me read verse 48 through 51 real quick. That's chapter 7, and I believe, that'll finish chapter 7. Verse 48, and Solomon made all the furniture which was in the house of the Lord, the golden altar and the golden table on which was the bread of the presence, and the lampstands, five on the right side and five on the left in front of the inner sanctuary, of pure gold, and the flowers and the lamps and the tongs of gold, and the cups and the snuffers and the bowls and the spoons and the fire pans of pure gold, all the hinges, both for the doors of the inner house, the most holy place, and for the doors of the house, that is, of the nave of gold. Thus all the work that King Solomon performed in the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things dedicated by his father David, the silver and the gold and the utensils, and he put them in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. As he's kind of putting the finishing touches on the temple. Good place to stop. Brought us to chapter 8, so we almost got caught back up. Let me pass those out real quick. This is week 3. Real quick. Sorry about that. I should have had those out quicker. Somebody help me. Thanks. We'll pick up with chapter 8 and then 9 through 12, so that'll give us... Here, I'll give you two more. Five chapters for next week. It's one or two. Okay. Thank you.